from WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour is made on your money, the $10 bill, in fact. The U.S. government will put a woman's face on the 10. There's been a national conversation about which woman deserves the honor. Last night at the Republican presidential debate, the GOP contenders weighed in on that question. You're about to hear their answers, and we're going to talk about what we learned from that moment. My guest in a moment is going to be Deborah Hughes, the president and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House, who's taking some time from her day while traveling. Let's first, if we could, we're going to get to that cut in just a second. Now, if you missed the debate last night, CNN hosted the debate, Jake Tapper, the moderator, and let me bring in Deb real briefly here, just to make sure we have her. Deb Hughes, who's the president and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Again, Deb, I know you're traveling on the road. Are you there? How are you?
I'm trying to find a quiet place.
You find a quiet place, and we're going to listen to what the contender said. This was a very, you know, usually these kind of questions I find somewhat silly or gimmicky, but the responses were fascinating. So Jake Tapper asked the question, who would you put on the $10 bill? And it starts with Rand Paul and goes down the line. Let's listen.
Ooh, that's a tough one. You know, I'm big on that we were, and I love what Carly said about women's suffrage. I think Susan B. Anthony might be a good choice.
Governor Huckabee.
That's an easy one. I'd put my wife on there. I've been married to her 41 years. She's fought cancer and lived through it. She's raised 3 kids, 5 great-grandkids, and she's put up with me. I mean, who else could possibly be on that money other than my wife? And then that way she can spend her own money to her face.
Senator Paul? No.
Senator Rubio, you
I'm
mean?
Sorry, Senator Rubio. I'm sorry.
I know we all look alike, right?
Just the senators.
The Rosa Parks. An everyday American that changed the course of history.
Senator Cruz.
Well, I wouldn't change the $10 bill. I'd change the $20. I'd take Jackson off, and I'd leave Alexander Hamilton right where he is as one of our founding fathers. And I very much agree with Marco that it should be Rosa Parks. She was a principled pioneer that helped change this country, helped remedy racial injustice, and that would be an honor that would be entirely appropriate.
Dr. Carson.
I'd put my mother on there. You know, she was one of 24 children, got married at age 13, had only a third grade education, had to raise 2 sons by herself, refused to be a victim, wouldn't let us be victims, and has been an inspiration for many people.
Mr. Trump.
Well, because she's been sitting for 3 hours, I think my daughter Ivanka, who's right here. Other than that, we'll go with Rosa Parks. I like that.
Governor Bush.
I would go with Ronald Reagan's partner, Margaret Thatcher. Probably illegal, but what the heck? Since it's not going to happen. A strong leader is what we need in the White House, and she certainly was a strong leader that restored the United Kingdom to greatness.
Governor Walker.
First of all, I got to say to Carson Huckabee, thanks a lot for making the rest of us look like chumps up here. But I put Clara Barton. I once worked for the American Red Cross. She was a great founder of the Red Cross.
Ms. Fiorina.
I wouldn't change the $10 bill or the $20 bill. I think, honestly, it's a gesture. I don't think it helps to change our history. What I would think is that we ought to recognize that women are not a special interest group. Women are the majority of this nation. We are half the potential of this nation, and this nation will be better off when every woman has the opportunity to live the life she chooses.
Governor Kasich.
Well, it's probably not maybe legal, but I would pick Mother Teresa, the lady that I had a chance to meet, a woman who lived a life so much bigger than her own, an inspiration to everyone when we think about our responsibility to love our neighbor as we love ourselves.
Governor Christie.
I think the Adams family has been shorted in the currency business. Our country wouldn't be here without John Adams, and he would not have been able to do it without Abigail Adams, so I put Abigail Adams on the bill.
All right.
To be clear, a lot of people thought he was going to go Wednesday Adams when he said Adams family. He's talking about the founding fathers, the Adams family. Deb Hughes is on the line with us, who is the president and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Deb, the question came up in the debate, so we heard the answers there. There's a lot of different ways to take this. What did you make of that?
Well, it's interesting that it didn't seem that any of the candidates were aware of what the Department of Treasury was about. You know, that we have the Secretary of the Treasury who's announced that there will be a woman on the $10 bill, and that's the whole project. But the theme is democracy, that one of the only requirements is that the person has to be deceased. I was kind of fascinated. It didn't seem that any of the candidates were aware of that whole national discussion of what the Department of Treasury was up to.
Now, let's kind of go down some of the answers here. The first person we heard is the only one who said Susan B. Anthony. That was Senator Rand Paul. And I suspect that answer gets a big thumbs up from you, Deb Hughes.
That would be my bias, absolutely. You know, the themes about democracy. Susan B. Anthony, I don't think there's anyone who represents more about democracy at its finest. She had a vision of what we could really be when we're a nation that's in of, by, and for democracy. That's what she pushed for the vote, so that everyone could be included in that. And she dedicated most of her life to human rights and freedom. She's a great example about how to participate in democracy. She organized local campaigns, state campaigns, national campaigns. She was a great representative for democracy. She traveled 3 times to Europe to talk about freedom and democracy there, and women's issues as well. And, of course, we nicknamed the 19th Amendment, the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, after her because it's the one that guaranteed women in this country the right to vote. So clearly she's an outstanding choice. I think there are a number of other women who've been nominated who are also great choices. Some of those that were nominated last night will be a surprise.
Okay, well, we're going to work down that list in just a second here. And in our segment here, which won't cover the whole hour, but if you want to call in and weigh in with your thoughts, Thomas in Greece, we'll get to you coming up here. And if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. So Rand Paul says Susan B. Anthony. And by the way, Deb Hughes, that is one out of 11 GOP contenders. So 9% of the Republican field favor Susan B. Anthony. Do you have any sense for where we are now in this process? I confess I'm a little outdated with where my own understanding is and if there's momentum for Susan B. Anthony.
Yeah, there's momentum. There are a number of people from the suffrage era, and my understanding is that we've split the vote a little bit, that people have different people that are really in support of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Alice Paul. Clara Barton, who also was nominated last night, is well known for her work with the Red Cross, but of course she also was a suffragette and was a good friend of Mary Anthony's and Susan B. Anthony's as well. And we support that's a good local connection. People know that the Red Cross started in Danville. Not everybody in Rochester knows that Rochester was the second chapter of the Red Cross, and they actually, I'm told, drafted the paperwork at the Susan B. Anthony House on Madison Street. I mean, preparing that. Another, Julia Ward Howe from the founder of the Girl Scouts, is getting lots and lots of votes. They've been able to mobilize a whole lot of young women to vote and support her. So she, last night, was just doing an outstanding run in terms of the response from the people.
We're talking to Deborah Hughes, who is joining us on the phone this half hour as we talk about the Republican response and the question over putting a woman on the $10 bill. And, Deb, the part that was a little distressing to me was, you know, Mike Huckabee says his wife, he's trying to be funny. He's always trying to be funny at debates. I get it. Ben Carson said his mom and did tell a compelling story about his mother, even though, I mean, I don't think that's, unfortunately, that's not a serious answer for who's going to be on the $10 bill. Donald Trump joked that his daughter for sitting through the debate. Do those answers strike you as non-serious answers about a serious question?
That was how it struck me. I think no one would fault any father from naming his daughter or any son from naming his mother as a woman that is a hero in his life. And women as well would name often parents or children as heroes. When we can't actually come up with a woman who is a symbol for democracy or an icon for our country, I do wonder about what that says about how seriously candidates take women in the country. And how much they value the role that we play every day today as well as in our history.
You had two candidates, Jeb Bush and John Kasich, mentioned women who are not Americans. Margaret Thatcher is Jeb Bush's candidate to put on the American currency. John Kasich's candidate for a woman on American currency is Mother Teresa. What do you think, Deb Hughes?
Well, those are surprises. When we've been having the forums, and recently there was a forum that Rosie Rios, the U.S. Treasurer, came to in Seneca Falls, we have always had the conversation framed. One, it has to be someone who's deceased. That's a requirement for the bills in our country. And then the other was the assumption that it was a United States citizen. So these ideas did seem to come a little bit out of left field, but I don't know that they were familiar with the discussion that we're having nationally.
And, you know, I will confess, Deb, I was sort of joining the rest of the world on Twitter last night with this debate. I kind of liked Carly Fiorina's answer, and, I know you're going to disagree on the idea of rejecting the idea entirely of putting a woman on American currency. I mean, my view is there should be women and men on American currency in essentially equal number, not just one. And Carly Fiorina saying this comes off as a token gesture just to placate women instead of taking women's issues seriously. I thought that was a strong answer. What did you think?
I thought that was a strong answer. U.S. Treasurer Rosie Rios is very clear, has been very clear, that this isn't, she uses the phrase, this isn't one and done. That right now we're having a discussion about who will the woman be on the $10 bill, because we know that the Treasury Department has already decided that the $10 bill is up next. It's up next because it's the one that's being counterfeited the most right now in this country. And that's what puts a bill into the opportunity of having it be changed. We were pushing a campaign to change and put a woman on the $20 bill and take Jackson off because they think Jackson's inappropriate. But the Treasury Department is really operating on different criteria. I think it's a fascinating position. I would agree. You know, I personally would probably say I don't know that we should have people on our currency. And I've said that, and people say, well, Deb, just get behind Susan B. Anthony. So if we're putting people on, then I think that there should be wonderful representation of what our country is about. There should be racial diversity. There should be forms of diversity on our currency if we're going to name people. And some of the other great women who've been named, Helen Keller, Harriet Tubman's a very, very strong candidate. She and Susan B. Anthony were the two strongest candidates in Seneca Falls recently. There are women in science, like Sally Ride would be an example. As Carla Fiorina noted, women have been a part of history as long as the country's been in existence, and there are so many. How do we select just one or even just a handful to stand out? But the truth is, we do. We put people on our currency.
Yep.
And so let's balance it a little more.
All right. So, Deb, we have every phone line filled up, and so we only have a few more minutes with Deb Hughes as we talk about this currency question, but let's get through some of your calls. And this is Tom in Thomas in Greece. Go ahead, Thomas.
Yeah, hello. Thank you. I was thinking, okay, keep Hamilton on the 10 because he established our system of national finance, our national debt. He favored a bank of the United States and well, the tariff, the protective tariff, when we were when we should have had one, when it helped our manufacturers, and he was anti-slavery too, and he also wrote pamphlets on the early part of the revolution, which favored the Patriots' cause. I would say for the 20, okay, take Jackson off the 20 because of his what he did, you know, the removal of the Cherokee, forced removal of the Cherokees, which actually happened when Van Buren, his successor, was in office. But he was the one who wanted to get the bill passed from Congress, and he favored the gag rule when he was the president in Congress, which forbade any discussion of slavery. I would say a good candidate on the $20 bill instead of Jackson would be, Susan B. Anthony, certainly, or Elizabeth Cady Stanton, or Frances Perkins, the first woman to be a president's cabinet member. She was the Secretary of the Treasury for Franklin Roosevelt, and she favored a lot of labor legislation, Social Security, and supported Social Security and the minimum wage and so forth. And she's another good candidate I could think of. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. What do you think, Deb?
Yeah, interesting discussion, as we said, about the Jackson versus Hamilton. I like the support. There's a strong response of people who feel strongly that Hamilton should stay on the bill as the first Secretary of the Treasury, and I feel he's a totally different kind of character than Jackson. I think that's a really interesting discussion to have. There are also discussions about what should be on the back of the bill Should we have memorials? Should we have moments in time? Should we have someone, Seneca Falls proposed that they should have that church where the Declaration of Sentiments was signed, or maybe we could have Rosa Parks on a bus, or are there contexts that could talk about democracy and our progress and depicted in pictures on our bills?
Michael on Twitter wants to know, have they thought about changing the person on the bill every 5 years, giving others an opportunity over time? Not that I know of, Deb, you?
You know, it's really interesting to hear. The bill that they're talking about right now is not going to be released for years. It takes years to create a bill.
And like 2020 or something. Yeah.
They have to test the content. They have to change the materials enough. They have to make sure that the pictures are very clear and hard to copy, and they have to then produce all of the equipment and machines that make it happen. So we can't even create a bill that would be printed in 5 years at this point in time.
That's a good point. Gary in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Gary.
Thanks, Ivan. I think, first of all, as a Rochesterian, I would support Susan B. Anthony. I think of all the women that have been mentioned, her influence and positive effect on this nation have been most extensive and long-lasting. But I will respectfully disagree with you in regard to the debate and Fiorino's answer. I think when people say things like, this is meaningless, to represent, whether it's a woman or any other group that's contributed so much to this nation, that it really demeans those groups. And I think you just need to ask the members of those groups, particularly minorities, that when they're ignored like this, that it is important. But my original point is this, is I was kind of, and I don't know if amused is the right word, amused about the number that mentioned Rosa Parks. And for what Rosa Parks did, fine. But here it is, you have 11 Republicans, you have a number of them mentioning Rosa Parks with applause, and yet at the same time, the Republican Party has done more to try to curb voting rights in America, the very thing that Rosa Parks stood for. So it really seemed kind of hypocritical. And like I said, I think amused was almost, I'm not sure that's even the right word. Thanks.
Thank you, Gary. I mean, I don't want to really get too far afield on the politics. I understand the point that Gary is making. Regarding Carly Fiorina, you know, Deb, it's interesting. Gary doesn't like what he heard from Carly Fiorina. I thought her answer was one of the most serious on the stage. There were certain candidates who clearly didn't take it seriously. Donald Trump said, my daughter, she's been sitting here for 3 hours, but sure, why not Rosa Parks? He clearly had not been thinking about this. Mike Huckabee not only jokes that his wife should be on the bill, but then it would allow her to spend her own money, which to me is, again, you're trying to be funny, but doesn't, Deb, that come off as a... Boy, that borders on sexism as a remark to me right there, doesn't it?
It does feel that way, doesn't it? And that they hadn't been reading the news enough to know that we were having this national discussion. I think, you know, I love the fact that I can get a brand new dollar bill and I've got Rosie Rios' signature on it. I think that there are people in this country, whether it's a gender issue, whether it's a racial issue, whether it's an issue of physical ability or other issues, it means something when you see a name that looks like your name or a face that looks like your face or hear an accent that looks like your accent. It's very powerful to children as well as adults as they begin to think, oh, that's someone like me. That's something that I could do. And it's a pretty powerful image. I think that it was pretty clear some kids hadn't even thought at all about, I mean, they haven't even been having an internal discussion about symbols, what is the place for women in our society, who are the women that they most respect and look up to. I wonder how many of them have put their list of potential cabinet people together and if they've even considered anyone besides their mother or their daughter.
Well, it was a strange answer from Donald Trump, who is so well documented to cherish women, whatever that means. Back to the phones. We only have a couple more minutes. Levy in Rochester. Next up. Go ahead, Levy.
Hi, this is Levi. And it's
Levi,
an honor
yes.
to be with Deb and Evan. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, first of all, I have family ties in Dansville, New York, so I think my vote would be Claire Barton, certainly. Just wanted to make a comment on what was talked about before about the kind of the comments that were by the candidates. I think that our culture tends to be, especially in this day and age with all the media, all the sound bites, hypersensitive to anything that may smack of being politically incorrect or derogatory. And I think that also in a debate, you have to take into account that they are debating one another. So the first person comes up with Susan B. Anthony. Some people might want to, you know, try to insert some humor. Some people would come up with somebody different. But I don't, you know, certainly with people as educated and respected as Ben Carson, I just wouldn't think that, you know, that answer shows something about how they view women in particular. I think that a debate, you know, they all have about a total of 4 or 5 minutes to talk, period, the whole night. And so, you know, to show a side of their personality, to show something like that, I think is not necessarily saying that they're derogatory toward women. You know, so that's my piece on it.
Levi, thanks for the phone call. It's a good point. I mean, look, you do want to make a splash or make a memorable comment, and maybe Mike Huckabee was just trying to be funny. You know, it didn't play well with the people I was watching with, but I think it's a fair point. I've got about less than 2 minutes left for Deb Hughes, who is generous with her time for us, and I want to go to Marilyn in Seneca Falls. That's an important place in this discussion. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Oh, thank you, Evan, for taking my call, and I certainly appreciate Deborah's comments also. I just wanted to say I had the privilege of speaking with Rosie Rios, the U.S. Treasurer. She is the 43rd Treasurer of the United States, and she was quick, you know, keenly aware that this is changing the whole conversation of women and representing women and being honored to women. And the U.S. Treasury Department is taking suggestions from the public, encouraging people to submit their ideas through the Treasury website as well as the social media using the hashtag #TheNew10. They were quite surprised that this went viral, but the decision is going to be announced in conjunction with the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote in 2020. So it's going to take a while. But the decision was largely driven for security considerations. I think the candidates last night are pretty typical of politicians who were really not aware of what's happening and aware of the feelings of the people in this country and half the population. I am very surprised that Ms. Fiorino would say that this wouldn't change history and that she didn't think that it was such a great idea. What we don't want to change history, what we want to do is make history in giving the opportunity to be on a $10 bill.
Marilyn, thanks for the phone call, and I know time is tight for Deb. So, Deb, just a quick reaction, and we'll let you go. Go ahead, Deb.
Yeah, great to hear from you, Marilyn. Interesting, it occurred to me, as I was thinking, when you ask who's the woman that should be on the bill, I love what is coming up, you know, when we're bringing up people like Rosa Parks and Harriet Tubman and Susan B. Anthony. Women didn't have access to a lot of wealth and power. But isn't it interesting that actually through history, the people that we remember are the people who really did something for society, who really did something good for others, who made a great change. It's not the people who built a great big building or were billionaires and formed great businesses. Those people are forgotten in a generation when those buildings are replaced. And it is wonderful that as we're having this discussion, the names that are coming forward are people who represent what is greatest in terms of courage, and commitment, and social justice, and work for other people. And I'm delighted that that's what this is about.
Deb, I know how busy you are. Thank you for taking time for the program, and we'll see you back here in Rochester soon.
Thanks, Evan.
Deborah Hughes is the CEO and president of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House in Rochester, joining us to talk about a woman on the $10 bill that came up in the GOP debate last night. Short break, more connections straight ahead right here. And coming up Friday on the next Connections, it's not the debut of Unleashed. It's the next episode of Unleashed, our second episode, and we are so excited about it. My colleague Beth Adams and so many people in the newsroom, Alex Crichton and others, working on bringing you stories of issues related to animals, your pets, talking to a veterinarian live, taking your calls. So first hour is Unleashed on Friday, and second hour, Second Opinion Live. Going to be a great day, and hope you join us Friday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Villa of Hope, offering trauma-informed care for youth and families in the greater Rochester area that are struggling with chemical dependency, mental illness, poverty, and neglect. More at villaofhope.org.
Go Public. It's a campaign about the future of WXXI in our community. Hello, I'm Sherm Levy. WXXI is proud to provide exceptional arts, music, news, and educational programming. You can help ensure the future of public media with a gift to the WXXI Endowment through your will, retirement plan, or insurance program. For more information, please contact Kathy Reed at 258-0319. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The George Eastman House is opening the largest Alvin Langdon Coburn retrospective exhibition in North America. And the curator of the original show from the UK is here for the opening, the only venue in the States and North America to see the show. And if you're like me, someone who is very interested in photography but doesn't always know the names throughout history, and Alvin Langdon Coburn is a new name to you, we're about to get a great history lesson as we get ready for this program coming up here. So let me introduce our guests right now. Pamela Roberts is here, really responsible for the show. Great to have you. Big Margaret Thatcher fan. And it's one, I joke, Pamela. It's great to have you here from the UK. You don't have to weigh in on the $10 bill. I was just watching her reaction in studio to Jeb Bush's answer. Nice to have you here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
She's saying, don't ask me about Margaret Thatcher, please. And also here is Lisa Hostetler, the curator in charge of the Department of Photography at the Eastman House. And Lisa, nice to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Pamela, first of all, let's just back up here. For our listeners who haven't heard the name, or maybe have heard the name Alvin Langdon Coburn but don't know much about the history of the work, what's the biographical sketch you'd give them?
Well, Coburn was from Boston, but he spent the first 18 years of his life in Boston, but then he went to London. And over the next 12 years, from 1900 to 1912, he went backwards and forwards between United Kingdom and the USA. And by 1912, he got married in New York and then went back to Britain and never came back to the USA. And I think that's probably why he's not as well known as he should be over here, because I think had he stayed over here, his career would have been more meteoric, because he was a member of Alfred Stieglitz's Photo Secession, and he was, I guess, what he felt about being involved with Stieglitz, who, as you may know, had a massive personality, was that Stieglitz probably rather smothered everybody that he worked with. So in London, Coburn was a big fish in a much smaller pond, and he was charismatic, he was not unattractive, he had energy, and he was a great photographer. So from that point of view, he was a kind of new thing in London. The London photographic scene was largely made up of older photographers, and here's this kind of hustling 18-year-old comes over. He claims he was shy, but he doesn't ever appear to be shy. He gets himself, he dresses in a very romantic fashion. He wears big rings, he wears silk top hats, and he goes out to be seen. But of course, that's no good unless your photography matches your personality and the picture you're putting out there. And his early photography, pictorial, quite romantic, quite soft, We have a section in the exhibition on his early work. And then you see the genesis of his work over the next 15 years until by 1917, he's taking these amazing abstract photographs called vortigraphs, which are kind of like a fractured kaleidoscopic image. And they're abstract. Nobody's done this before. Nobody's shown abstract photographs like this. And what happens when he shows them in London? Everyone goes, he's mad. He's totally mad. You know, nobody can. It happens. You're ahead of your time. People can't understand it. That stage, he kind of he never gives up on photography. But there are other things in his life which are coming to mean more to him.
He went to London, as you say, when he was 18 years old, so around 1900.
Yeah.
And even at the time, what did contemporaries think of a brash, late teens, early 20s figure, you know, making a splash on the scene? How was he received?
Well, he came over the first time with a distant relative, another Boston photographer called Fred Holland Day, who, despite being a flamboyant extrovert, and dressing in robes and taking photographs of himself as Jesus Christ on the cross, he did have a lot of friends in the London photographic scene. I would have loved to have met him. He must have been an incredibly convincing person. He introduced Coburn to his friends, who accepted him because he was introduced by their friend. And then Coburn started working on a series of portraits of the London literati. And his first photograph was George Bernard Shaw, who was like, I guess, not so well known these days, but at the time, like the most famous.
We've got a Shaw Festival around here. Yeah, he's appreciated. It's not too far from here.
He's appreciated. Right, yeah. Good. I should say in Britain, he's not that much appreciated these days. Although he has been revived at the moment, there's been a couple of revivals. But he liked Coburn. Shaw himself was also a photographer, a reasonably competent photographer. He took to Coburn. The two got on very well. And he was the open door to London society. And he introduced Coburn to lots of other novelists, H.G. Wells, poets, W.B. Yeats, people like George Moore. He wrote letters for Coburn. He kind of became something of a father figure, I think. Coburn didn't have a father at this stage. His father had died when he was 9, very suddenly of a stroke. And he was, his constant companion was his rather dominating mother. So to get to England and to be mentored by someone like Shaw and H.G. Wells must have been really quite an exciting experience.
And so tell me if I'm wrong. I'm sure I'm wrong. Tell me if I'm wrong.
I'm sure you're right.
When I look at Coburn's career, I kind of think of it in this bifurcated sense that younger years, pictorialism, I guess. And then again, that shift as he got older. Is that a fair way to kind of divide the work that he did, or is that too simplistic?
Yeah, no, there is a definite shift. And I think it comes something like about 1905, he went to Italy in 1905 and he caught typhoid and he almost died. He was very ill for about 10 weeks. And there's a letter that he wrote after that, in the end of November 1905, saying, memento mori, I guess. He was feeling that he could have died quite young. So he was determined that he was really going to make his mark. And he said, everything I've done up to now is, it seems like it's been done by somebody else. I'm going to change. It's going to be better. It's going to be amazing. And that is the start of the shift when he started getting more radical with composition.
And that's a big idea for a 23-year-old. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a midlife crisis kind of idea, not a 23-year-old's idea, but I guess flirting with typhoid can do those things. But how do we define what pictorialism is, by the way? And how would you define that for people who are not familiar?
Well, it's the turn of the century, the photography being accepted as an art form. And kind of to some extent, what they did was try and make photographs that looked like art. So the British press used to call them fuzzy graphs.
So they would soft be focus.
Soft focus. They'd be nothing very definite in there. There'd be lots of women carrying in long white dresses, carrying globes and looking soulful. It was a kind of one way ticket to nowhere, I think. There were some beautiful things.
But they also experimented with processes a lot, because the idea they were trying to combat this idea that photography was a totally mechanical and automatic machine kind of thing, that there was room for creative expression. And so they would choose printing processes that showed the mark of the hand. Either you brushed on the emulsion yourself or you made a platinum print with pigment over it. And so that there was a real sense in which each photograph wasn't the same as the next, that they were unique prints. And they were also heavily influenced by symbolism in a lot of ways, so that this sort of romantic kind of allegorical subject matter was a huge part of the movement as well.
And so why was it a one-way ticket to nowhere then, Pamela?
There are always very beautiful things, but it didn't really progress to anything else, is what I meant. There are only... Alfred Stieglitz published a camera work publication from 1903 to 1917. And if you look through that, you see that there are a lot of women in long white dresses with globes. And gradually it gets tighter and harder. And at the end, it becomes something we call straight photography, I guess, the work of Paul Strand. So I don't think there was ever any hard pictorialism, as it were. I mean, it just kind of disappeared. It faded out.
Okay, and go ahead.
And I would say, I think people's... the idea was, or the new idea that came about, was that, well, it doesn't have to look like something else in order to be artistic. It can look like a photograph and still be artistic. So in some ways, in the beginning, they needed to make room for the idea that there could be creative expression in this medium in the first place.
That's a very interesting idea.
And then once it sort of came to that, was beginning to be more accepted, they were like, well, now we don't have to make it look like an engraving or a carbon,
you don't have to convince anybody with a flourish that you're doing something artistic. The photography itself could inherently be artistic.
Exactly.
Very interesting. So then in throughout the rest of his career, then Pamela, again, we're talking to Pamela Roberts, who help put together the show the George Eastman House has. And in a moment, we'll tell you about all the details coming up, so how you can see it and check it out. Alvin Langdon Coburn, after he fools around with pictorialism, for the rest of his career, what's the peak of his work? What stands out to you? And again, tell us about sort of where he progressed as an artist and as a photographer.
Well, He, as I said, he went backwards and forwards between London and New York for 12 years. And to me, the peak of his work is he began to take a lot of industrial photographs. He went to Pittsburgh and took some amazing bird's eye views, almost, of Pittsburgh, and kind of this distortion, purposeful distortion in the images. Like, he took station roofs and from up high, and they're curved. He's done some clever thing with the lens that makes this happen. Then he goes to New York, and he ascends the Singer Building, which had just been completed, goes to the top, to the viewing tower, and takes photographs looking down. And the interesting thing with that is he goes with a cubist artist, Max Weber. Weber paints. They're on the Singer View. I would have killed to have been there. The two of them on the viewing platform. Weber painting and Coburn photographing, and he's trying to achieve cubist photographs. So he's very influenced by Weber. And that gets him, obviously, right away. Cubism couldn't be further from pictorialism than anything. So to me, those photographs are really, really powerful and doing something that nobody else was doing at the time.
Lisa, when someone comes into the George Eastman house and says, I've never heard of this guy, how do you describe sort of the highlights and the peak of his career, post-pictorialism?
I would agree with Pamela that it was really this moment when he's starting to move away from pictorialism, and that elevated view gives him a different perspective. And I love how in the book and in the exhibition you point out the connection between his trips to the Grand Canyon, where he sees sort of all these elevated views, and he's kind of enveloped in nature and inspired by the majestic scenery, and then he comes back to New York again and looks down from above with a similar sort of inspiration from that perspective. And I think those pictures that he made really started to show the way forward to a more a time when photography and avant-garde sort of painting and sculpture and the rest sort of move in tandem for a period, an extended period between the wars, or during World War I and then between the wars, and he sort of foresees that.
Mm.
And so, Lisa, what does it mean now to have this exhibition here at the George Eastman House?
I think it's a really major event for us because we, the director, Beaumont Newhall, who was the first curator of George Eastman House and then became the director, had a very good relationship with Coburn, and Coburn bequeathed his estate to the museum. And this is the first time in a very long time that his best works from multiple collections have been assembled. So it's a rare opportunity to really understand and appreciate photography at a key moment in its history. We have sort of materials or ephemera from his personal collection. So we've got rings that to me look like props from Sons of Anarchy. Like he really had this
the big rings.
Yeah, these specific, they like motorcycle club rings. And then tarot cards and other kinds of games and opium pipes. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, he was really sort of part of the bohemian avant-garde art community, and you get a sense of the man, but then you get a sense of this great work that he made. So it means a lot both to the museum, but also I think to the field of photography to understand this person that really, I think, changed the discussions around photography and kind of pushed it in a new direction, even though he kind of retired to Wales and thought about spiritualism for the rest of his life. I don't know. I know you've done a lot of looking into how the work got here. And
spiritualism.
Yes.
He hung out with the Fox sisters.
No, he was in Wales. No, so by this time.
Yeah.
He might have done, though, if he'd been over here.
Yeah.
I don't mean to laugh for spiritualists in the audience. We'll talk about that on a different day. But Pamela, I'm curious to know. I think he's been dead for more than 50 years now, right? Langton has, and so, you know, you're putting together this kind of presentation to a public that might not be familiar with him. And it's their introduction to him and his work and his life. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what kind of responsibility you feel for that kind of presentation, because it is interesting to hear about the ephemera and the look into the person, and then to have to decide how you navigate someone's professional career. Do you feel sort of a weight of responsibility with that?
I've been coming to Eastman House doing research for about several years on and off, and one of the archivists there said that I was stalking Coburn. I am kind of dabbling in his private life, but he was good at destroying things that he didn't want people to see. But I have found out things that he probably wouldn't have wanted me to find out. Because to me, the private life illustrates the photographs and vice versa. So I do have a giant database, and I can more or less tell you where he was any day of the year.
You
so
are kind of a stalker.
I'm stalking him. But I think you, to me, the way I work, I like to find the human being behind the images, and I hope I've done that, and I hope that when people come to the exhibition, they see the most beautiful images, and it does look very, very beautiful, the exhibition. But they also get a sense of him as a man, just flesh and blood like the rest of us.
I think we'd all feel fortunate in the future if anyone was telling our story, that we did take a human approach, that it isn't just the photographs. I think that's wonderful. How many photographs, by the way?
Oh, 150? Something like that. The exhibition actually opened in Madrid at the end of last year, and it was much bigger there, about 190 photographs. But I think the edit has actually done it good. Makes it more potent, I think.
Alvin Langdon Coburn's work, and you can see it now. Well, let's talk about that. So, Lisa, what do you have coming up here, and what should our listening public know now?
Well, tonight is the opening. It's a members opening. Members can come for free. Non-members, it's $15. Pam will give remarks at 6. And then from 6:30 to 8:30, you can see the exhibition. You can make your own vortigraph. You can get a tarot reading. And you can generally enjoy the exhibition and with other people who are there to see it as well.
And Pam is worth the price of admission anyway, if you're not a member, by the way. If it was just Pam lecturing on Coburn, I'd be there, let alone seeing the rest of it. So that's tonight. So it starts at 6 to 8:30 at the Eastman House. And again, free for members, $15 for non-members. And then?
And then on Saturday, November 21st, our Associate Librarian Virginia Dodier is giving a talk about what he did after he retired from photography. So based on the archival materials we have in the collection, kind of sort of addressing that idea.
Mysticism.
Mysticism, the universal order, yes. Mm-hmm. Freemasonry, he got very interested in.
Of course he did. Why wouldn't he? Pamela, was there anything that surprised you when you were doing your research on this, doing your stalking, so to speak?
Stalking. Well, he's got a lot of opium pipes. You know, how many do you need? And they have a sticky brown residue in the bottom of them, some of them. And I thought, well, okay, you know, he'd had a few operations and he said he had them without anaesthetic. So I thought, well, maybe he just smoked the opium and didn't feel the pain. But doing research, I found that he was a diabetic. And I found that end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, opium was quite often prescribed for diabetics. And it was thought, there doesn't seem to be a lot of proof, it was thought that it would help reduce blood sugars. But that could have been the reason he tried it, or he may just have enjoyed it. Why not?
And again, let's define a term, because we've talked about pictorialism, we talked about a vortigraph, but just defining what a vortigraph is, can we get a definition on that, Lisa?
So he made this, he and Ezra Pound were friends, and they, vorticism was this movement of in England of kind of futurist artists. And they made this device to put on the lens of the camera that refracted light so that it abstracted whatever the subject matter was. And I think at first they were photographing Pound, mm-hmm. And then they just started photographing bits of crystals and glass and mirrors and such.
Good description, Pamela?
Yeah, they're kind of coy about how they did it. Pound said it was three of his shaving mirrors taped together in a kind of triangle and then put over the lens of the camera, so when the camera was fired, you would get reflections from the glass and then they started putting bits of crystal and bits of wood. But Pound also writes that he'd made several different vortiscopes, he called them, the camera type thing, and that he could make as many as were necessary. But after Coburn exhibited the vortigraphs in London in 1917, and they got very bad reviews. They got a lot of press, mind you, so no press is bad press. But I think he was quite disappointed that people didn't understand that here was something totally new, that the camera starting off doing the pictorial soft focus thing, could now do something totally abstract.
I always thought the British press likes to hold people up. They don't like to tear anybody down, right?
It just must have been an off day, I think. You're right, obviously.
Yeah. We should mention as well, I just saw the date of his death. It's coming up on 50 years, 1966. And just if you needed any more evidence or a reminder of the place of the George Eastman House in our community, he bequeathed, Coburn did, his photographic estate to the Eastman House before dying in 1966. So if you need any more evidence, George Eastman House and what it is they do. So some brief final thoughts. We've got a minute left. Lisa, we want our listeners to hear.
Well, I just hope that they come and enjoy the show and kind of see how different photography was 100 years ago from how it is now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Pamela?
I think Coburn has been sidelined, very much so. But last December, one of his photographs sold for $965,000 at Sotheby's in New York. So you can see he's somebody doesn't think he's been sidelined. Somebody thinks he's well worth collecting. And I guess once he hits $1 million, this will get people's interest. It usually does. Money, doesn't it?
That's true.
Pamela Roberts, the curator, the creator of the show, thank you so much for your time here today, Pamela. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Lisa Hostetler is the curator in charge of the Department of Photography at the Eastman House. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
And you can see the show, and again, that's the event tonight, the event coming up in November about spiritualism and all the other things that made this man so fascinating. Great history lesson today. And always great stuff to see at the Eastman House. Hope you enjoyed the program today. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Val LaBanca, our engineer. And I will talk to you tomorrow. We're Unleashed is back on the air first hour. Second Opinion Live, second hour. Have a wonderful Thursday afternoon.